Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another TopCon Talks Agriculture podcast. I'm your host today, Jared Oakes. I'm a product manager of Global IoT and the TopCon Agriculture platform for TopCon. Thanks so much for jumping on our podcast today. Today, we're really excited to have an awesome guest speaker. I'm going to do a short introduction, but I want him to give a little information about himself, a wealth of information coming from UW-Madison. Today on the podcast, our guest speaker is Kevin Erb, CCA. Kevin is the Director of Conservation Professional Training Programs at the UW-Madison's Division of Extension Natural Resources Institute. That is, I thought I had a mouthful of a title, Kevin. You've got me beat. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. Thanks for the invitation to join you in the audience today.
We're so happy to have you. I'll share with the listeners in preparation for the podcast. You know, you've been sharing some PowerPoints and some other things with me, and just really, really insightful information, really well done decks that I know if anyone has attended one of your remote sessions or maybe a live one before the pandemic was occurring. Really well done, you know, simple information, the way it's formatted. And I hope we can get some of that messaging digitized on the podcast here for our listeners and go through it. But can you give our listeners, Kevin, kind of an idea what's going on at the Division of Extension Natural Resources Institute? What are you guys working on up there? What's going on?
So my program focuses really on a couple of different areas. One is, it's reflected in the title, doing professional development and continuing education for the certified crop advisors, CCAs. And you mentioned earlier that I'm a CCA as well, but also those agency staff, whether it's with the federal agencies, the state agencies, or the local conservation agencies, working with farmers. Because as we know, technology is always changing. What worked for conservation and for agriculture 5 years ago may not be applicable today. And so keeping those folks up to speed on not only the latest in technology, but also relating to farmers and understanding the unintended consequences sometimes of some of our conservation practices is really important. And so that's one of the areas that I focus on. Another area that I do quite a bit in, Jared, is working with the for-hire manure applicators across the Midwest. Yes. And those farmers that are applying their own manure as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got a training program that we've put in place that's available online, but we also work with the insurance industry as well, really to look at how can we create some market-based incentives. So can we reward the farmer? Can we reward that commercial manure applicator for making changes in how they manage their operation that result in insurance premium savings that really hit the bottom line very well?
Yeah. And, you know, putting that incentive on things really moves the needle on some of those programs for sure. I know there's some hoops to jump through and some documentation. Sometimes the participants in those programs they've got to commit to what it takes to go into one of those. Documentation's a big one. Now it sounds like you guys are connected in about everything and just churning out the content left and right. You mentioned farmers, you mentioned insurance industries there, and these for-hire contractors, the manure applicators. There's so many regulations. Is that manure management? Is that even the right vernacular? Is that the right term? What's the lingo on the street when it comes to this?
So it really depends on the audience and who's talking. I mean, typically when we're looking at this from an agronomic perspective, from mm-hmm. a regulatory perspective, what we're really talking about is nutrient management or nutrient management plans, which encompasses not only manure, but commercial fertilizer and that free nitrogen that we get from rotating out of soybeans, out of a legume, into a corn crop or into a cereal crop. So that's really the preferred term. I've heard a few people now talk about it more from the perspective of fertilizer management, but nutrients is more encompassing of not only the commercial fertilizer that we buy, but manure that we get, municipal biosolids that some of our producers out there are applying on their land, and also looking at the natural sources of fertilizer that we get from atmospheric deposition as well.
Now, with the manure management primarily in these contract kind of haulers, right, these contract applicators, I mean, there are so many pieces involved in this plan, and I've been involved in quite a few discussions and meetings with some of those groups. There's a lot of moving pieces to that, whether it's the, you know, maintaining the slurry, and there's just a lot that goes into it. Now, you guys said you had some things online, and I'm sure you do some things in person. For specifically for these courses, for these manure management applicators to stay really in the know on all the restrictions and the risk mitigation strategies, how do you guys stay on top of all the changes with all that?
Well, it's really a combination of things. And so obviously the other piece of the puzzle here is the innovations that are coming out, not only from industry, but from individual farmers and individual manure applicators that are really innovating, creating new equipment, adapting existing equipment, and really making things happen and moving things forward.
So these producers that have a problem that needs solved, they're developing some of this technology on their own then?
Yeah, they are. And so I'll just give you an example here, Jared. So we look at a farm that maybe has a liquid manure storage. Mm-hmm. And we know that the phosphorus in that manure as it comes out of the cow, 85% of that for a dairy operation or beef operation is in the solid portion of manure. And so we put that in the manure storage. Of course, the solids settle to the bottom. And when I start to pump that manure out and apply it to the field, if I don't do a good job of thoroughly mixing and agitating that,
yeah,
then if I'm taking the liquids off the top, the stuff off the top is very diluted,
right,
low nutrient content. But the closer I get to the bottom, the richer it's going to be. And so if I just grab a single manure sample and say this is the average across the 100 loads or the 1,000 loads that come out of this manure storage, well, the first 40% of that field that I apply on is not going to have enough nutrients and the crop might suffer. Whereas the last 80% or 40% of the acres I apply on might be the opposite. We might have too much out there, which not only has environmental concerns, but in some cases, animal health impacts as well. And so looking at the innovations, what a lot of our manures and farmers realized was it takes a lot of diesel, a lot of horsepower to put in 3, 4, 5 agitators and get that slurry mixing and moving the entire time it's pumping. And so we had a couple of manure applicators that said, you know, what if we could get something out in the middle there to actually do some agitation? And so some folks literally built a boat and put a prop type agitator on that. Other guys built dredges, but other folks put a pump on this, sucked up from the bottom, had nozzles. And what we see with those agitation boats is we cut fuel usage by 75 to 80%.
Right.
We get a much more uniform product, but that was an innovation that originally came from a couple of manure applicators, literally welding a frame together, bolting a motor on it, and attaching it to plastic pickle barrels and floating them out on the lagoon and playing with it. And over time now, industry has begun to look at that, taken that idea, created more innovations, and now we have these that actually are motorized, can drive right into the pit and drive right out when you're done. And so the innovation out there, I mean, farmers are incredibly good at figuring out solutions to problems. And particularly when it comes to manure management, doing things that we can do to mitigate the risk. And that's really a big part of this too, is whether it's herbicide drift, whether it's runoff from manure or fertilizer applications, what can we really do to minimize the risk of loss to the environment?
Yeah, and sounds like the one of the biggest positives here is just managing that inconsistency of that product. I mean, in my role at Topcon Agriculture, Kevin, I do travel to other regions quite a bit, and I know you know, in Europe, they've made a lot of, you know, advancements in this area and much stricter regulation, even in certain parts, right? I am familiar with a company, I can't think of the name right now, but it is one of these machines that drive in, and it's even autonomously controlled, you know, where it basically follows a pattern in, you called it a manure storage area, or I believe, but I know it as maybe a different term, but yeah, it's just disrupting all that all the time. Well, before they go apply it, it really, really a fascinating output. And some of these systems, I know, even in some of the presentations you sent over, Kevin, talk to the listeners about what they have for options. You know, if they have you know, a manure applicator, are there systems out there they can retrofit? Are they, in your experience, useful? Do they, you know, do they work? Are they affordable? How would somebody even get started managing their manure, you know, their manure management program in a better way? What advice would you have for them?
So I look back at my experience on our small beef operation where I grew up in central Illinois, and our manure management system was basically when we were home from school for Christmas break or for a holiday or whenever, that's when we get out the old Oliver tractor with the bucket on it. We clean out the beef areas, load it in the spreader, and go out and spread it just to get rid of it. Right. And that was really the philosophy that a lot of farmers had. You know, manure is a waste. Let's just get rid of it.
Get it out of here.
As fertilizer prices have gone up over the years, we've got a greater environmental awareness. Now we're really treating manure more as that fertilizer resource that it is. But at the same time, we know that spreading manure during a rainstorm, frozen ground, when things are melting here in spring, and we get those heavier rainfall events, we've got the greater chance of losing that and realizing that there's a lot of fertilizer value in manure. When we do have runoff, not only are we worried about the environment, but we're also losing valuable fertilizer nutrients that now we've got to go to the co-op or to our dealer and pay to replace. And so what's happened is, as a result of that, we see a lot of farms have invested in manure storage. We've seen a switch over to a more liquid type of manure management, particularly for the dairy operations, where we're trying to capture all of that liquid from the parlor wash down, the pipeline, et cetera. And so,
and you see a lot of liquid injection systems typically, more than, say, liquid surface application typically?
So we've shifted away from solid manure to liquid. We've shifted away from surface application to injection. But at the same time, for every, this is our average number here in Wisconsin, for every milking head I've got on a dairy operation, I'm collecting about 10,000 gallons of parlor water, manure, waste feed, rainfall, and everything else. Well,
10,000 gallons per head in a growing season kind of calendar year.
In a 12-month period. That's what I'm looking at. And so what we've seen is, because we're dealing with liquid, we've gone to liquid application. We've started off with the tractor pull tankers, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 gallon size.
Yes.
Then we got to the larger tankers. And what we see real growth in right now is putting it in a 6-inch, 8-inch, or even a 10-inch drag hose and irrigating it 2, 3, 4 miles down the road, or putting it in semis, taking it down the road and then transferring it into something and using that hose system in the field itself. Now,
yeah, drag line application. Sure.
Yep. The benefit of that is that I can get that injected, so I'm reducing odor, ammonia loss, and managing things for the environment. But the other thing is that if I'm doing it right, I'm minimizing the amount of mud being tracked on the road, manure being dropped, minimizing the road damage. And as we look at how agriculture has changed over the last 30 to 40 years, I mean, it's no longer a 30-20 John Deere taking the 125 bushel manure spreader out there.
Yeah.
It's a 200 horsepower tractor, because you need something big enough with braking power, hooked to a 7,300 gallon manure tanker or to one of these dragline systems. And so, particularly going down the road, we've seen a real problem, particularly in the upper Midwest here, with heavy ag equipment, whether it's grain wagons, semis, manure tankers, whatever, really doing significant damage to our rural and township roads. And so we've been working a lot with the local road officials here in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. We did a research project in Minnesota where we built a third of a mile of asphalt pavement and then over a three-year period tried to destroy that, not only with heavy farm equipment, everything from a 3,000-gallon manure tanker to a 1,000-bushel grain cart, but also with an 80,000-pound and a 102,000-pound overweight semi. And what we found on our asphalt roads was that if I can keep the center of that tractor or tanker tire 16 inches or more from the edge of the asphalt, I cut my road damage by over 80%. And so you start thinking, well, how do I keep this really big equipment away from the edge of the road? And we have farmers that will sit down with their town board officials, with the county highway department, and literally make roads in the middle of farm country one way for a half a day, a day.
Oh, really?
And that way they can drive down the center of the road. Well, the nice thing there, other than preventing road damage, is that you're not having to pull off to the side for oncoming traffic, whether it's your own empties coming back or neighbors.
Just safer for everyone overall.
Much safer. The sheriffs love it because it is safer and you're more efficient. You can get 15 to 20% more loads done in a day if you do this right.
Well, I think that's fantastic. I think I wasn't sure if, I mean, there's damage on roads for sure. And if anything we can do to, I guess, protect what's left of some of the infrastructure, we need to do it for sure. So that's fantastic. I wasn't aware. Now these, I'm sure these are pretty well coordinated efforts, obviously. So it sounds like when they put one of these programs in place, it is, well, it's quite literally go time for these manure contractors, if you will. So they're really moving a lot. They're cleaning a lot out. And this is, I'm sure, primarily in the fall that a lot of this takes place, right?
Well, it's fall, but it's also some in the spring. And ideally, we want to put that manure nutrient out there at the time of greatest crop need.
Well, sure.
But we have a lot of folks that are top dressing manure on alfalfa. And one of the projects that Ohio State's been playing with, we've played around with, is actually going on with one of these hoses, which 6-8 inches in diameter, and literally applying in a cornfield when that field corn is 3 to 4 leaves tall. And the thing about corn at that short height, assuming soil conditions are good, is literally you can take a lawnmower to a cornfield or you can knock that corn flat and you're really not going to set it back that much because the growing point is still below the surface. As long as you don't damage that growing point, that corn will continue to grow and you're not going to see a significant negative impact to flattening that corn with that drag line. And so it's particularly for the swine operations, which is where a lot of this work has been done in Ohio. If I can get that manure out there in May and June when the crop actually needs it, that's really beneficial because our corn crop from germination to about knee high uses between 2 to 4 pounds of nitrogen per acre. From knee high to tassel,
yeah, you're getting that food to the right to the hungry plant at the right time. But man, you've got to have a story where you were on the edge of a cornfield at 2 leaf and watched, well, we're standing by a guy watching his corn get literally destroyed by a line. His face had to be, Kevin, I hope this is a good idea.
Yep. And
I can't even imagine that. But yeah, you know, from an agronomic point of view, of course, yeah, the corn is below the surface. So, but man, the uneasy feeling sinking in your stomach has to make you wonder.
Well, even my own impression of this, because the first time I saw it, I'm thinking back to how my dad was not happy when I turned in the headlands to cultivate, but I knocked down more corn than I should have. And here I'm looking at this flattening this entire field, but it's like, you know, corn, like I said, 2 to 4 pounds of nitrogen per acre until knee high, but from knee high to tassel, 2 to 4 pounds of nitrogen per day is what that corn crop needs. And if we can get that out there at that uptake,
agronomically, it's definitely the right thing at the right time, right place, right time, you know, a 4 hours for sure. Now, you know, on the precision, I know the GPS systems and all the electronics, you know, lots changed. And you've obviously been working on a lot of these programs and seeing a lot of things evolve over the last several seasons. And I know our customers, you know, face these challenges all the time. Do you see, you know, more and more readiness to get some of these electronic systems on, or do folks, you know, Kevin, do they still default back to that story you said about, you know, we come back when we're free or we're available and we get the tractor out and we just dry spread the manure, you know, give the listeners an idea. I'm sure we've got some on the podcast that are just doing it the old way, applying it on top. Like you said, get rid of it. And then there's definitely a group that are in this more liquid slurry methodology, these different application techniques. Maybe they even have sophisticated NPK measurement, you know, optical systems on these applicators. Give us a sense of where do you think the spread is on those two trains of thought?
Yep. So currently, I mean, if we look at precision agriculture, we saw a lot of adoption starting late 80s, early 1990s, the Corn Belt, because you had yield monitors that came along, you could do variable rate grid sampling, and you could actually fine tune the fertilizer to the soil test. We couldn't do that in livestock systems because manure nutrients are variable. And that made it more a challenge, and particularly for those guys harvesting forage, silage, hay, et cetera, haylage, we didn't have the ability to accurately measure yields there. But as we've gotten into this precision arena with newer technologies, we can now vary manure rate. We've got the lifetime nutrient sensors on the market from multiple companies now for liquid. We have a few companies right on the cusp for solid manure that can measure nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and dry matter real time as manure is being applied to the field. So the innovators are out there. They're beginning to look at this, using this technology not only to precisely apply, but also to document what they've done so that they can prove to anybody that questions in the future, yes, we did things right.
Yeah.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, we've got the more traditional guys, and it's expensive to retrofit older equipment.
Sure.
And so those folks, what we're seeing is folks look at what we call a hazard mapping system, where literally they're putting an iPad or a tablet in the tractor with a field map and a dot that shows where you are. So at 9 o'clock at night when you're spreading or spraying, you know exactly where you are in relation to the neighbor's fence row, everything else, and it makes it simpler, but at a cost of less than $200 per piece of equipment.
There's price points that meet everybody's needs then. Yeah, there's really no reason why not to do the right thing on this documentation. Now, I would imagine these newer OEM you know, these newer applicators, these newer machines, these liquid injection machines, et cetera, most of them are at least offering maybe a factory installed option when they sell the machine, or the brackets are there, right? Like the punch out is there so you can retrofit some of these. Do you see more and more of those machines each and every year coming on?
We're beginning to see a few, but the thing about farmers and manure applicators is they love tinkering in the shop. And as long as the equipment is modifiable, they'll figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. As they go through this, and like you said, with the rising prices of fertilizer, like you know, this is worth something. This isn't just the old let me get rid of it thing anymore. There's no reason to be that way. What's the involvement from the agronomic, you know, teams that these growers work with, or you know, maybe even some of these input suppliers? This is obviously part of a much broader plan, right? In most cases, these farmers aren't only going to have manure as their fertility plan. They're likely going to have other components of that for crop care and yield optimization. Are you really seeing kind of teams come together? If it's the agronomist, the input supplier, the seed, you know, the variety selections, are these farmers really pulling together a team of trusted advisors and putting all the pieces in place?
That, I think, is where we're going to be 4 to 5 years from now. We see a few folks on the cutting edge of things beginning to really pull together that broad scale team. Right now, because it's mainly the certified crop advisors, the agronomists, and the consultants writing that nutrient management plan, they're working with the farmer, generally bringing in that custom for-hire applicator at some point in the process and coming up with a solution that's working for all of them. But I think in the long term, yeah, we are going to be looking at what particular variety with what particular traits and attributes of various seeds do we actually plant into certain fields. Particularly as we start looking at the whole issue of cover crops and the need to have that little bit wider window in the fall. And we've seen farmers, particularly in the Corn Belt and in the livestock areas, really pushing that corn maturity, longer and longer season corn. And while there's a definite yield benefit to doing that, there's also the risk of an early frost, but it really reduces the window you have to get that cover crop put in. And so what we're seeing a number of our livestock producers now do, particularly after the really wet years of 2018 and 2019 in the upper Midwest, is really look at, you know, can I cut back the maturity on that corn by 5 days? And what does that actually do to my overall total yield or tonnage that I'm pulling off of that field?
Yeah. Where's my threshold? Yeah, yep. Really finding that sweet spot.
Because as we look at things like cover crops and soil health, there's a lot of things that we're really beginning to learn that we didn't realize out there.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, there's so much soil and soil sciences. Obviously, I still believe, Kevin, it's a bit of an art form still. You know, there hasn't been a seamless, I guess, transition of knowledge from, say, you know, grandfather and generations. I mean, these farmers know their soils, they know their land. Do you see any apprehension, you know, ever with some of the folks you work with about some of these systems and some of the, you know, some of the advancements in technology, maybe advising them or automating some of these? Or is it really positive? Are almost everyone willing to try some of these things?
So it really depends on a number of things. One is the willingness of the producer to really be open to trying new things. Because really, when you're talking about changing the system, you're talking about taking somebody who feels they're competent and a fairly good expert at managing that cropping system or managing that livestock operation. Yeah. And now throwing a curveball. And as a farmer, you get maybe 40 growing seasons in your career.
In your lifetime. That's right.
There's not an opportunity to have a do-over if you make a management mistake that has a significant negative impact on the bottom line or on the yield. And so farmers, really what I'm finding, are asking a lot of questions. They're thinking through all of the various aspects of this innovation or that change and saying, you know, what could go wrong here? What are the risks? And what steps do I need to take to minimize those risks? And the people that are successful with the newer innovations out there are the ones that are really thinking it through, taking time over that cup of coffee or whatever, and just thinking about it.
Do you see some younger, you know, generations? I've talked about that a little with some, you know, with some past guest speakers It's always, you know, interesting to hear the insights of our guests with, you know, younger generations coming back to the farm and getting more involved in some of these, more technically involved systems. Do you have any experience with that, or do you have any interesting, conversations to share?
So I think that the newer generation is coming at farming from two different perspectives. One is that they're more open to looking at some of these innovations than the older generation was. But quite honestly, I think back over my career, and that older generation 20 years ago when they were younger, they were open to a lot of newer things as well.
They were the same way. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, exactly. Like looking back into the mirror. That's right. And I think you touched on, you know, something really, you know, important, Kevin. The way you phrased it was wonderful. You said that most, you know, producers only get 40 tries, you know, in their lifetime. And that's once they commit to a game plan and they get equipment and they gain a level of comfort and they have had some wins, mm-hmm. right? Like that's how those things get really concreted in. I know, you know, on our farm, whether it was transitioning to no-till or maybe planting some corn in a field nobody thought corn would work, those things are risky decisions, you know, but I do see more and more folks trying new things, and that's exciting. Any other things to share on the precision systems for manure management? Any other topics about agronomy? I know the CCA program is a really amazing system. You talked earlier about some of the CCA programs and credit, you know, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with that CCA program, the credits behind it, been around a long time. Most of the agronomists up in your area there that you serve, Kevin, they're probably taking part in all those programs.
Yeah, we have, I believe, between 450 and 500 certified crop advisors in Wisconsin currently. And you think about, well, it's a credential, but as a CCA myself, I have to go through 40 hours of continuing education every 2 years.
Right.
Now, that is actually more hours in some states than attorneys have to do to keep their law license. Right. And so realize that CCAs are responsible for helping that farmer make those management decisions when that corn isn't quite as green as the farmer wants it to be. When that,
yeah, who does he go to? He goes to the CCA and says, "Why? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me now." Yeah, exactly.
That's what I find is that when farmers are looking at adopting precision technologies, they're mm-hmm. reaching out to that agronomist and saying, "You know, what do you think? Not only is this feasible, but is this actually going to pay off?" And so,
yeah,
on the manure side,
will it help us choose a better decision path? Right.
Exactly. And will that information help us in the long run? I mean, that's
right.
We look at over time, having good data is essential. And the National Weather Service forecasts now are accurate down to within almost a mile and a half by a mile and a half square grid. If you look on their website and drill down on the map, but that's really only there because of the data that they've been able to use to validate the models. And so precision is not only happening in agriculture, with live nutrient sensing, where we're measuring nutrients as we're applying manure, with the live on-the-go nutrient or manure density sensing, which is actually a product that Topcon has for solid manure spreaders that actually measures or looks at that weight of manure and adjusts the spread pattern, tractor speed, apron speed, or chain speed and apron, to try to get that uniform nutrient application out on the field.
Well, you said it. I wasn't going to do a shameless plug on our own podcast for one of our products, but you are right. We do manufacture a product specifically for manure management and these increased practices. So thank you for mentioning that. Hopefully folks will check us out on our website and find a distributor in their area and learn more about that. On the CCA, you know, as we kind of start to wrap up, Kevin, on our podcast, thanks so much again for joining us today. Is that CCA program, you said 400 plus up there in Wisconsin, is that, you feel like that's growing quite a bit, or is it, you know, fairly stable at that number year on year?
Right now, it's fairly stable, I believe, but don't quote me on this. Of course, we're recorded, so I am being quoted here. But I believe it was higher than that about 15 years ago when we had a lot of interest in writing nutrient management plans, and the credential was required to do that. And what we've seen is that some of the CCAs out there have said, you know, the credential is not as important for what I do, whether it's the spraying or something else. And so just like farmers have tended to specialize, we see our agronomy consulting community doing specialization as well. But over the past few years, we've really held fairly steady with a number of certified crop advisors out there. And if a farmer wants that unbiased third-party advice, it's definitely available.
Yeah, I know quite a few folks, you know, here in Kansas and Nebraska, you know, other areas that they are CCAs. I talk to them quite frequently. A wealth of knowledge, and like you said, really open, great communicators, very familiar with the program. Thanks for sharing that with us. I think that we can have you back to talk about some of this cool technology, whether it's satellites or more sensing systems, a wealth of information. Kevin, I can't thank you enough for jumping on the podcast today and covering a wide variety of topics I know our listeners will enjoy hearing about. Do you have any parting comments for the listeners? Maybe it's advice for a 21 successful season or anything you'd like to share?
Well, I think the key thing as we look forward into the future is to fully look at any technology before you invest. And there's a lot of really neat, flashy, gee whiz things that are out there. But you really need to be asking yourself, you know, is this something that I'm going to be able to have a return on investment? And return on investment, in my mind, comes in a couple of different ways. Obviously, it comes in the terms of increased profitability. Am I making more money per acre than I was previously? But the other part of it is am I able to use that data, that information, over the next 3, 5, 10 years to make much better management decisions? And so as we look at yield monitor data, what we're seeing in some areas is that consistently we are losing money on certain parts of the same field every year, whether that's a low spot, whether it's really close to that row of trees from that house that's out there. And so I think in the future, we're really going to be parsing that field down, looking at individual half-acre pieces or areas and saying, am I really making money farming this? And if I'm not, what's the best option? Is it on the extreme not to plant that half acre low spot? Is it to invest in drain tile? Is it to say, I'm not going to put as much fertilizer down on that area because I never get a profitable return?
Well, I think those are fantastic parting words. Find a partner, focus on profitability, but see the value in the data. I think that's extremely important. Kevin, thank you so much again for your time. We really appreciate it. Thanks to all the listeners. This is another episode of TopCon Talks Agriculture. Be sure to go back and listen to some past episodes. And thanks for listening.